featuring over 50 social service agencies providing info on housing, energy, county assistance, and more. All are welcome. Looking at weather tonight, partly cloudy skies with highs 50 to 57, calm winds.
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Howden. Coming up on As It Happens.
Parting jab. It was the opposite of quiet quitting when Dr. Dimitri Daskalakis and three of his colleagues resigned from the U.S. Centers for Disease Control in protest. He tells us the greatest risk to the health of the nation is ignoring science in the name of politics.
And gift card. In 2005, her home was destroyed by Hurricane Katrina. On the 20-year anniversary, a Mississippi woman tells us she could hardly believe it when a stranger reached out recently to say she'd found her high school ID card, which had been lost in the storm, and wanted to return it.
Those stories and more coming up for you on the Friday edition of As It Happens.
It is 6:01, and you're tuned in to As It Happens, a CBC program, here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingel. We receive support from Dale's Auto Body, serving the auto body needs of Grand Rapids and surrounding communities since 1984, performing auto body and collision repair, as well as auto glass replacement, dedicated to getting you back on the road after an accident. More information at dalesautobodyinc.com. After Dark is KAXE Saturday night program after Green G's from 9 to midnight, featuring styles of music like punk, metal, EDM, R&B, hip-hop, and more. This week's hosts, the Clockows, are playing heavy metal. Interested in hosting? Email dgannon at kaxe.org. Support comes from AW Research Laboratories in Brainerd, reminding private well owners to test their drinking water annually. Common well contaminants such as bacteria, nitrates, and arsenic are odorless, tasteless, and colorless. More information and test kits available at awlab.com. And Grand Rapids River Fest is Saturday, September 6th. This year's lineup, Courtney Barnett, Margot Price, Jeremy Albino, and Alan Sparhawk. Tickets and info at grandrapidsriverfest.com. Now we're going to hear a song from our headliner, Courtney Barnett. This song is called Pedestrian at Best.
I digress, at least I've tried my very
And that's Courtney Barnett with Pedestrian at Best. Check her out at Grand Rapids Urban Fest, Saturday, September 6th.
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
Good evening, I'm Chris Howden. This is As It Happens. Tonight.
In the pipeline, the federal government has made it clear it wants to make Canada a natural resources superpower, and who better to explain how they plan to do that than Canada's Minister of Natural Resources.
Second opinions. Dr. Dimitri Doskalakis just quit his job as the CDC's vaccine chief, but he says his work fighting misinformation in the U.S. is only getting started.
Object lesson. 20 years ago, a Mississippi woman lost everything in Hurricane Katrina. 2 weeks ago, she met a stranger who found a small piece of her former life, and it was a life-changing moment for both of them.
Man drill sergeant. After thousands of performances, Broadway legend Sidi Manier is leaving the role of Rafiki, the mandrill in question, in The Lion King. She tells us how she felt the love every night.
Unextended family. After nearly 40 years, the family channel is going dark, breaking the hearts of the Canadian former kids who grew up watching it. Ashley Leggett, who played Casey on Life with Derek, tells us what life without the channel means.
And here comes Peter Quantum Tale. To defeat an invasive army of pythons, Florida has deployed a high-tech squad of solar-powered robot rabbits, which look and smell like the real thing. As it happens, the Friday edition, radio that's worried they're breeding like robots. It's been a week of announcements from Prime Minister Mark Carney, and today he announced another major project, the new Major Projects Office. It will be headquartered in Calgary, and it will oversee all infrastructure projects deemed by the government to be of national importance. It's a key part of Bill C-5, the contentious legislation designed to fast-track approvals. The first projects haven't been officially named yet, but this week Prime Minister Carney has been dropping hints that they will involve building port and pipeline infrastructure to export critical minerals and liquefied natural gas, or LNG. Tim Hodgson is Canada's Minister of Energy and Natural Resources. We reached him in Markham, Ontario.
Minister, it was announced today that Don Farrell, chair of the board of directors of the Trans Mountain Corporation, is going to head this new office. What message do you want that to send today?
I hope what people take from it is we couldn't find a more competent and capable person than Dawn. You know, she's got a 35 plus year career in building projects. She's done it in all aspects of energy and natural resources. She was the CEO of TransAlta, which led a conversion of the business from coal to renewables, and then was asked to step in and get the Trans Mountain project done, which she did in a very effective way. When you look at that type of experience across that breadth of activities, I'm as a Canadian thrilled that someone like Dawn is willing to step up and serve her country in this way.
Now that this office has been created, what can you tell us about when the first major project, whatever it is in the end, there'll actually be shovels in the ground?
What the Prime Minister has said is we should expect to see the first projects getting announced over the next couple of weeks. I think what Canadians we'll see as a small number of projects get announced initially as the ball gets rolling, and then over the fall you'll see more projects as proponents bring them forward and qualify them under the Act getting announced, and you'll start to see shovels in the ground this fall.
The Prime Minister said earlier this week that that list of projects could include new port infrastructure in Churchill, Manitoba. That would open up the possibility of exporting LNG. But as you know, there are many interested parties in different regions of the country about who should be first, what should be first on that list. So how will you decide which project should take priority?
So So I don't think one should draw from the first projects that they are taking priority. What one should draw is as proponents bring projects forward and they qualify based on the five criteria, they will get designated. And that's why I think you'll see a rolling announcement as people, as proponents and provinces bring projects forward. We will run them through the major projects office, and if they meet the criteria, they will be designated.
There are certainly people all across this country, as you well know, who are feeling the very severe effects, very real effects of climate change right now. What would you say to Canadians who take a look at this plan to make Canada, as the government has said, a, quote, energy and natural resource superpower, unquote, and wonder how the government plans to do that while also meeting its emissions goals?
So we have said from the very beginning, we need to do both. We need to develop our natural resources given the reality in the world right now, and we need to do it in an environmentally responsible way. That is what we will do. That's a key part of the Major Projects Office to make sure we are getting that done, and importantly that we are getting this done in a timely and efficient manner so we can attract the capital that the country needs to build these projects in an environmentally responsible way.
So they shouldn't be worried?
No, I think Canadian. Look, I have to tell you, I was in Germany this past week, as I think you know. Germans, who are some of the most environmentally conscious people in the world, and we have a government that's very environmentally conscious, the reality is they view natural gas and LNG as a transition fuel. They realize they need more of that transition fuel and they will need it for longer. They are desperate to get that fuel from places like Canada because they know Canadians produce some of the cleanest and lowest carbon footprint LNG in the world. We do it in a responsible way. We do it in conjunction with First Nations. If the Germans are going to be buying it from someone, I think Canadians expect them to buy it from us, given how we produce it. And that puts Canadians to work. That uses Canadian steel and aluminum at a time where we're under pressure. That puts revenue in provincial treasuries and federal treasuries so we can pay for the programs to help Canadians get through these difficult times.
You mentioned Indigenous leaders. Certainly there is agreement among some with what you're planning. Others don't feel the same way. In July, when the Prime Minister was meeting about Bill C-5, I spoke with Chief Namox, Wet'suwet'en Hereditary Chief, about his feelings about the government's obligation to consult with Indigenous communities on big projects like this. Here's a little bit of what he told us at that time.
This is not consultation. We were never, ever asked to meet and talk about this. You made this decision, you made this law without us, and now you're trying to tell us that, hey, it's all about prosperity when you're actually taking everything off the environment and there will be nothing left for our children and grandchildren to live on because industry will remove it.
How are voices, Minister, such as the voice of Chief Namox, being considered as this government looks to start taking on these big projects?
Well, I hear what the chief says. I would respectfully say that there are 600 plus First Nations in Canada. We have started a dialogue with many of them, as well as Métis Nations and Inuit people. And what I heard, and I attended all of the sessions, was the majority, a significant majority of First Nations chiefs are quite interested in participating in the benefits of major projects, particularly if they're done in consultation with First Nations, which we've committed they will be, and that there is significant economic benefit for First Nations, which we have committed there will be.
Minister, great to have you on the program. Thank you for this.
Thanks a lot. Take care.
We reached Minister of Energy and Natural Resources Tim Hodgson in Markham, Ontario. This is a tough time of year for Kathy Hamill. It was 20 years ago this month, August of 2005, that the Mississippi resident became one of the hundreds of thousands of people whose homes were destroyed or severely damaged by Hurricane Katrina. The storm devastated parts of the southern U.S. and killed more than 1,000 people. Ms. Hamill lost her home and nearly all her belongings. But earlier this month, she was reunited with one item that she'd lost in the storm, her high school ID card for the 1969-1970 school year. A stranger named Becky Copeland, a wildlife biologist and park ranger at the Gulf Islands National Seashore, found it, and then she tracked Ms. Hamill down. We reached Kathy Hamill in Diamond Head, Mississippi, and Becky Copeland in Collins, Mississippi.
Kathy, I'll start with you. Having survived what you did during Katrina, I know this is usually a very difficult time of year for people in the same situation as you were back then. How do you mark this anniversary?
I actually mark it with, a little bit of sadness, but also gratitude that I survived the storm, and in spite of everything that happened from New Orleans all the way to Mobile, there's a lot of people who fared worse than I did. So, just a moment of reflection and a moment of prayer for everything that we went through and the fact that I still have my life. Yeah.
And then to have this experience of meeting Becky this month, holding your high school ID again, how does that fit in now to what has been often, as you said, a very sad time?
Very, very emotional, very emotional. And in a way, it was just kind of a blessing from above, because I'm still in total shock that the ID lasted 20 years. And the fact that she's an angel, because she did all the legwork to find me to return it.
Becky, what is it like for you to hear that from Kathy?
I mean, this whole thing has just been, I mean, as Kathy described, it's like a blessing. It was probably a blessing I didn't know that I needed, just to be able to return that to her and to be able to meet her. It's kind of beyond words.
And Kathy, as comfortable as you can be talking about what happened 20 years ago, can you share a little bit about those moments, what you were doing, how you sheltered when Katrina hit?
Yes, I realized that I would have to evacuate my house because I was right on the Bay of St. Louis. I had a good friend that I worked with, that her parents had a house over in Waveland, Mississippi. She called me and she says, "Will you please go stay, Mom? Daddy won't leave." She said, "He won't leave his house." And I said, "Yeah." I said, "If they'll have me, I'll go over there." It was raining and blowing. I mean, the wind was unbelievable. But we thought we were a high enough elevation that, we wouldn't flood or anything. And you could look out in their yard, and it was like a river was just coming up the street, up to the yard, up to the house. And it was coming in so fast. And we got up in the attic and just prayed the whole time.
It's so terrifying, Kathy, to even hear you talk about it all these years later. But when you finally got to see what was left after the storm, I mean, you lost everything, right?
When we were able to go to Bay St. Louis, to the area that I lived in, and that's when I looked over my shoulder and I realized, oh, that's my street. That's where my house was.
Nothing left. And
gone.
Do you remember, an ID card like this? I can see it maybe sitting in a photo album or a box somewhere in a house. Where was it in your house? Can you remember?
It was in my closet in my bedroom, and it was in one of these little metal safe boxes, like a little fireproof box. That went from Bay St. Louis and floated, or somehow blew all the way out to Horn Island. It's just beyond my comprehension.
Becky, let me bring you back in. I mean, we're talking about a card that's more than 50 years old, well over a decade, almost two decades after the storm. Can you describe what condition it was in when you found it? Because you took a picture at that moment. I've seen it. It's hard to make out much of anything.
Right. Yeah. I mean, when I was looking, I was doing nesting shorebird work. So I'm looking at the ground and looking for, small shorebird nests. And I just come across it in the sand. It wasn't in any sort of, you know, trash or debris. It was just in the sand. And I picked it up, and I'm like, oh, my goodness. Like, I saw the year 1969. I could see the name of the high school. I could see Birmingham, Alabama, but I couldn't see anything else. It was so dark and weathered, but still intact. I thought, wow, this is so cool. And I thought, oh, my goodness, like, how is this here? You know, I didn't have any idea about the story behind it. I could never in a million years imagine the story behind it.
And so you put it away. You put it away for a bit. What made you pick it up again?
I put it on my shelf, you know, didn't really revisit it at all. And it was only, you know, 2 weeks ago I had recently found another message in a bottle, and I was just kind of making room on the shelf to put another bottle there. And I picked the idea up, and I gasped. I couldn't believe it. I looked at it, and clear as day, her name had appeared, the date of birth, the grade, and the ID had lightened enough over the years being out of the elements and dried out that the identifying information became legible, and I couldn't believe it. And yeah.
Amazing. And so what did it take? I mean, social media played a big role here, Becky. So how long from that moment of realization that you can make out more of the information to actually being able to call up Kathy?
It was quick. I mean, as soon as I saw it, it was a Sunday night, and, you know, I was getting ready for work the next day. But then, you know, as soon as this happened, I was like, internet detective just took over inside of me, and I ended up going to the high school's Facebook, you know, friends page. And I posted it as, like, you know, a Hail Mary if anyone could find her. And I think by the next day, the admins of the page had published the post on their page. And I think within an hour of it was getting hits. Someone had put her name, like, right there. And, you know, everyone was commenting that was who, it was Catherine. It was Catherine Hamill. And then I had her sister's friend messaged me on Facebook and said, that's Kathy. She lost it in Hurricane Katrina. She lost everything in Katrina.
And you end up meeting face-to-face just a couple of weeks ago, but there's a photo of both of you sitting on a couch together, and you have your arm around her, Becky. I mean, you really do look like very old friends. And I'll ask you both this, but Becky, you can go ahead. What was that face-to-face meeting like for you?
It felt like I had known her forever. It felt like a you know, a kinship immediately.
Kathy, for you, that meeting?
Oh, the same way. When, you know, when I put my eyes on her, I thought, oh, this was divine intervention. It was meant to be, you know?
You know, you talked about how you feel grateful now. But after everything you've survived, just having a piece of your life before Katrina, what does that card mean to you?
You know, it means a lot because, you know, and I've repeated this before, I said, you know, after the storm, everybody keeps saying, it's just material things, you have your life, but, you know, the mementos that you had for those first 50 years, it meant the world to me, because when I saw it on Facebook, I said, oh my God, that's me. I said, I did exist, you know?
So you found yourself again, in a way, and this new friend. Kathy, Becky, I'm really glad you both found each other, and I'm glad we could speak. Thank you for this. Please take care.
All right. Thank you so much.
Yep. Bye-bye.
That was Kathy Hamill in Diamond Head, Mississippi, and Becky Copeland in Collins, Mississippi. We've posted some photos of them and the ID card on our website. That's cbc.ca/AIH. Some of you are about to stare blankly at your radios, but some of you are about to experience an overpowering swell of emotion. I told you. And those of you who are tearing up right now might have heard that song almost daily while you were growing up. It's the theme to the Canadian sitcom Life with Derek, which was about the rivalry between two step-siblings in a blended family. It aired on the Family Channel, which was also the Canadian home of hit Disney Channel shows like The Wizards of Waverly Place and Hannah Montana and The Sweet Life of Zack and Cody. But now, after nearly 40 years, Family Channel is signing off. The Canadian media company behind the network, Wild Brain, says it was unable to work out a new broadcasting agreement with Rogers. In a statement, it also pointed to a previous decision by Bell to remove the channel. Ashley Leggett is an actress. She starred as Casey McDonald in Life with Derek. We reached her in Niagara Falls, Ontario.
Ashley, there certainly has been a lot of change in television overall, but in programming for young people as well, and not just in Canada. So I'm wondering if you were expecting at all to get this kind of news that the Family Channel was going to shut down.
I know it's been pretty dire for children's programming for a few years now. I was shocked. I truly didn't expect it to get to this point. Saw it on one of the social media sites, and I thought, well, there's no way. That can't be right. And sure enough, I spoke to, you know, colleagues and people who worked for Family Channel, and they confirmed it. And it was shocking for everyone.
As our listeners heard, the network was a platform for Disney Channel shows, but it was also a platform for Canadian-made shows like the one you were on. What do you think this losing that kind of platform might mean for children's television production in Canada?
The sad part is, as we were growing up, you know, we had all these this amazing content, and a lot of it Canadian made. So it was so nice to be a part of something bigger in Canada. And, you know, it worries me. I have children, and at this point, I'm concerned because there is such a lack of quality family programming, and it's kind of just pushing kids now to YouTube or these sorts of streaming sites that are not safe. And it's sad because I can't trust what I'm putting on for my kids to watch now.
A lot of our colleagues who grew up with your show and the Family Channel, as soon as they saw this story, they were shocked and really upset. It wasn't even just the shows, the commercials. One producer told me the whole experience meant a lot to them. But for people who didn't watch that, it's foreign to them. When was the moment you realized that this channel, but also your show Life with Derek, was, I mean, I don't know if popular is the right word. When did you know it was a thing?
You know, I, of course, was a Family Channel kid, and I truly think Life with Derek was on during its most epic era. You know, you had all these like massive hits, and I don't think Michael and I truly realized how huge our show was until Family Channel had the idea to do this kind of anti-bullying rally across Canada, which again was one of the reasons I love this channel, because it wasn't just about programming. It was about helping kids and standing up for kids and having kids have access to the actors. And it was just like a family. It really was a family. And so Michael and I came down the escalator at this mall during one of our stops in our mall tour, and there was thousands of kids screaming. And we couldn't believe it because we had no idea our show was even popular. Anybody knew what it was. And that was probably the moment I realized that it was an actual movement and Family Channel was responsible for all of it.
What have fans told you through the years about what it meant to them?
Well, in that time, I think blended families was still kind of not portrayed too much on TVs, specifically kids TV. So I have had so many people say, like, you know, my parents got divorced and I had this new step sibling that I couldn't stand. And, you know, seeing your show made me realize that that's normal, and just how to kind of navigate those issues with a little bit of comedy and a little bit of like, I can relate to what they're saying, you know? And so many people have said that our show has gotten them through some of the hardest times when they were growing up. And it makes me really sad that children now are not going to have that connection.
Your Instagram page, I think, says the girl from that show, which leads me to believe that people still stop you and recognize you and talk to you about it.
All the time. All the time. And it's so nice because, you know, this is now the time when people come up to me and say, like, you have no idea how much your character helped me with this. Or, you know, I met you at this anti-bullying tour with Family Channel. And, you know, at the time I was being bullied really heavily, and it was really nice to just talk to you about it. You know, and you don't realize, I think, at the time how important these little things are, but it can truly be make or break for some kids.
The initial assumption, and certainly it's one that I had, is that certainly the Disney shows are already on Disney Plus or will be. What about shows like yours and the Canadian ones. I mean, should we assume that they're just going to end up on streaming and new generations will get to see them?
I mean, I guess that's the hope, that they will still live somewhere, but I really don't know what happens at this point from a programming standpoint. I don't know what their plan is, if they're going to try and sell them now to streaming. I just don't know. I haven't heard. Yeah.
As someone who was such a big part of young people's lives, what would you say to producers and bosses at networks making these deals, or in this case, not making these deals?
I would just remind them that children's programming is so important. We've seen the issues that come from kids just spending countless time on YouTube. And of course, there's programming on there that's fine as well. But this was for everyone. This wasn't for kids that had a smartphone. This wasn't for, you know, particular kids that had access to things. This was for every kid on their home channel that they could sit and watch and feel like they were part of something.
Do your children know that you were a pretty big deal for a lot of people?
You know, what's funny is they know something because people come up a lot, but they think when they see the show that it's a home video and like Mike is their uncle, and like they just don't quite understand it was scripted. They're not sure why they call me Casey on there, but they just think it's just home videos. I haven't gone into too much detail with them on that
because
they're still little, but yeah, it is funny. When people come up, they're like, did they see the home videos? I'm like, okay, well, sure. kind of.
Something like that.
Something like that.
Well, Ashley, I'm glad we could speak. Thank you for this.
Thank you so much. It's nice to chat with you, and I hope that this will have some momentum towards fixing this.
Ashley Leggett played Casey McDonald in the Canadian TV series Life with Derek. We reached her in Niagara Falls, Ontario, earlier today. And, you know, while we're still in the thick of Family Channel nostalgia, here's Miley Cyrus with Seven Things.
I probably shouldn't say this, but at times I get so scared when I think about the previous relationship we shared. It was awesome, but we lost it. It's not possible for me to care. And now we're standing in the rain, but nothing's ever gonna change until you hear, my dear. The seven things I hate about you.
Miley Cyrus with Seven Things.
We're going to take a short break now. When we return, the CDC's now former vaccine chief tells us what he worries might happen next for the health of Americans now that he has quit.
And two divers in Nova Scotia get shockingly close to a curious great white, and solar-powered robot rabbits set out to catch pythons in Florida. Stay tuned. I'm Chris Howden.
And I'm Neil Cooksell.
It is 6:35. It is 6:35. And you're tuned in to As It Happens, a CBC program here on member-supported KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Coming up at 7 o'clock, it's going to be On the River with your volunteer host, Doug Danger. That'll be from 7 to 10 p.m. Donating stocks and mutual funds is a quick, easy way to defend KAXE from funding cuts. You may receive tax benefits as well. Call Sarah for details at 218-326-1234. The Virginia Area Historical Society's annual Fall Fest is Saturday, September 6th in the Lions Club building at Olcott Park, starting at 4 p.m. with grilled burgers and brats. The featured speaker is Mark Sage, who will talk about Frank Higgins, one of many sky pilots during the logging era. Looking at weather tonight, partly cloudy with highs 50 to 57, calm winds. Tomorrow, patchy fog early, then mostly sunny, highs 77 to 80 degrees.
The Centers for Disease Control has a new director for now. After days of chaos and resignations by leaders at the health agency, Jim O'Neill has been named the new interim director. He's currently the deputy under Robert F. Kennedy Jr. at Health and Human Services. But that has hardly calmed concerns on both sides of the aisle about how politics is infecting the organization. Republican Senator Bill Cassidy, who chairs the Senate Health Committee, said an upcoming meeting on vaccine policy should be canceled or that the results should be ignored due to the turmoil at the CDC. Turmoil that included the resignation of the head of vaccine policy, Dr. Dimitri Daskalakis, who quit over the Trump administration's questionable approach to science. When he and two other agency leaders walked out for the last time, colleagues and supporters lined the streets to give them a supportive clap out. Clutching a bouquet of flowers, Dr. Daskalakis said this to the crowd.
And America needs to see that you are the people that protect America, and we are going to be your loudest advocates.
Dr. Dimitri Daskalakis was the director of the National Center for Immunization and Respiratory Diseases at the CDC. We reached him in Miami.
Doctor, standing out there, surrounded by your now former coworkers outside the building where you worked for so long, what was that like? What were those moments like for you?
It was frankly a surprise. I thought we were going to have 20 or 30 people, and I didn't expect to see hundreds and hundreds of people. The joy that happened there was not about leaving. The joy was about seeing the people that make up CDC and the people that keep America safe. I think, you know, we're in a place where they've been dehumanized, very often villainized. And I hope America could see what I saw. I hope you could see in Canada what I saw, which is people who are extremely dedicated. Those are the people that keep health safe in the U.S. Frankly, keep health safe in the globe with the work that they do.
And now you can and clearly are speaking out publicly along with the others who have resigned in ways that they can't. For you, though, I can imagine that there were lots of discussions and conversations, weighing of pros and cons over a longer time. What was, if there was, you know, a breaking point? Because you said in your letter, enough is enough. What was the moment you decided enough is enough?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there were really two things. The first was, you know, the ongoing changes that were being implemented at the Advisory Committee for Immunization Practices, or ACIP. They released a document that did not have really any input from subject matter experts that said what the terms of engagement were in the work group that was going to discuss COVID-19 vaccine. And so that really for me meant, frankly, ideology was going to contaminate the science. And the second thing that made me know that it was impossible to stay, when it was clear that Susan was likely not going to be able to hang on there.
This is Dr. Menares, who was the director.
Yes. Yeah. So it was clear right there that we weren't going to have what we needed, the scientific leadership, to be able to make sure that the science could stay free of ideology and undue influence. So that was the end. First, do no harm. I'm a doctor. I was there seeing that all I could possibly do is harm. And so it was time to go.
The White House has framed this, as you know, that Dr. Menares was relieved of her duties because she's not interested in making the country healthy as the administration is. For listeners, and we have listeners around the world, certainly in the United States, who are not concerned about what is happening at the CDC as you are. What do you want them to know about the people who work there? You've hinted at it already. And whether they care about the health of Americans.
So I think just like Dr. Menares, people that work at CDC, all they talk about, all they think about is the health of the people that they serve. There is no ulterior motive. There is no bias. These people live and breathe to make sure that folks live healthy. And they are mission-driven. I have never met such mission-driven people. Let's face it, we're all nerds who work in public health. They're the most fabulous nerds that you will ever meet. But all that they're thinking of is, how can I keep my community and my neighbors, my friends and my family healthy and safe?
What do you make of Jim O'Neill being appointed the interim director?
Yeah, I don't really know very much about Mr. O'Neill. My sort of first gut is that, you know, a scientific agency needs scientific leadership. I can't speak to his scientific chops. You know, I would feel uncomfortable working in a hedge fund without listening to experts. So I hope that he will feel uncomfortable working in a public health agency without listening to his experts as well.
If you're saying Americans cannot trust the CDC right now, who can they trust? Who should they trust?
You should make sure that you talk to your medical provider. If you're a parent, talk to your pediatrician. If you're an older person, talk to your primary care doctor. If you are someone in middle age or a young adult, talk to your doctor, talk to a pharmacist, and really figure out what's right for you. We're seeing a great number of very, very good professional organizations that are putting out guidance that really doesn't meld with the guidance that's coming out of CDC. That's a red flag. And at this point, I would go with my doctor before I go with guidance that doesn't make sense.
Are you worried, though, that by leaving, by resigning, as much as you do interviews and continue to advocate, that you would have still had more power to keep things on track had you stayed?
Yeah. If I felt that I would have been able to steer this in a direction that would still serve the health of the people that I serve, I would not have left. I think that there is a irresistible force that is pushing CDC's data into a place where it will be contaminated by ideology. And I don't see a way that that won't happen, given the way that that things have been orchestrated by the secretary and the folks that work with him at HHS. So I'm highly concerned that we are not quite at the point of no return, but we're getting there. I definitely was at the point of no return for what I could do. And that's when the time comes to leave and be a voice outside of the agency.
What does the point of no return look like? What is the impact?
The bottom line is that that this will manifest itself as people who can afford the least to be impacted by infectious diseases and other chronic diseases and things that could injure them. That means that the most vulnerable populations are going to suffer. Their health is going to decline. They're not going to be able to work. They're not going to be able to love. They're not going to be able to support their children. And that also means that people are going to die. As I felt death by a thousand cuts that led to my resignation, I think that public health is having more than 1,000, maybe 1,000,000 cuts, coming to the point where it's not able to function. And that's going to mean bad health outcomes, and that's pain and suffering for people.
Doctor, I appreciate your time. Please take care.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, and I hope you have a good day.
That was Dr. Dimitri Daskalakis, who resigned from the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention this week. He's in Miami. When you go diving, you expect to see fish. You'd be disappointed if you didn't. But when Eric Peterson and John Brooks got into the water just offshore near Hubbards, Nova Scotia, they definitely did not expect or necessarily want to come nose to snout with one of the world's biggest fish, not to mention one of the ocean's apex predators, a great white shark. Mr. Peterson is a diving instructor. He had taken Mr. Brooks out on a guided dive when the shark showed up. He told the CBC's Andrew Sampson what happened.
We were at Fox Point Beach, which is just right over there, and it was I was taking a guided dive with a retired U.S. airman, and we were just out on our second dive. And about 15 minutes in, it just kind of came up out in the murk, and you just saw these big black eyes and this Cheshire grin, and this face was just kind of coming up out of the water at us and just slowly looking at us. And I was just in shock and joy that I was experiencing this. So on a scale of 1 to 10, I had zero fear. I was just so pleased to be in that situation.
You know, you're with a diver that you're kind of leading on this expedition.
Yep.
What do you tell him, or what do you kind of do at that point when you see the shark?
Right. Well, the first thing was he was signaling that we should go up, and that's the last thing you want to do, because the surface is actually where most, like, shark encounters actually happen. That's their natural environment for predation. So the best thing to do is stay on the bottom. So I told him to stay, and I took a hold of his harness, and we just sat on the bottom on our knees and just let the shark come up and sniff us. Came straight up to us, like playing a game of chicken. And just stare him down, and then she passed away, passed to the left and disappeared and came back out of the murk two more times. But this time she went up and over us, and we think she was sniffing our bubbles. And at like 12 feet, that's small for a great white. This was a juvenile. So we believe that the shark was just curious, probably never saw divers before and just wanted to know what we were.
Could you have reached out and touched the shark?
Yes, 100%. It was that close. It was like closer than you are to me right now.
Diving instructor Eric Peterson describing a recent unexpected encounter with a great white shark in waters near Hubbards, Nova Scotia. He was guiding novice diver John Brooks, who's visiting the province from Florida. Here's what Mr. Brooks had to say about the experience.
We're swimming along. All of a sudden, Eric pulls me by my strap there, and he points, and I look, and there was this amazing creature. It was just beautiful, but at the same time it's like, that's a shark, what the heck? But it was, I'm still getting a buzz on that little run there, that little ride. He just like came in out of the mist. He was like all of a sudden whoosh, and there he is, like, whoa. So back up, just take it easy. If he wanted us, he could have had us either way, but he was just like circling around, just. And he had a bunch of his other little fishy buddies with him as well. And they're just along for the cruise and like circle and circle and just, you know, just being curious. A lot of these creatures in the sea are just curious.
Remarkably composed novice diver John Brooks talking to the CBC's Andrew Sampson about his face-to-face encounter on Wednesday with a great white shark in the ocean near Hubbards, Nova Scotia. Cast of The Lion King performing Circle of Life, and at the heart of that song and of that Broadway show is Rafiki, the eccentric shamanistic mandrill who narrates the story, played for a record-breaking 9,000-plus performances now by Sidi Manye. Now, after decades in that role, she's preparing to take the stage as Rafiki one final time. This Sunday evening's performance will be her last. We reached Sidi Manye in Jersey City, New Jersey.
Sidi, when anyone in the audience watching The Lion King, you know, when they first hear you start to speak and sing in the Circle of Life, I mean, I'm getting chills just remembering it. And I was just watching you a video of you do it as well. Truly, it is moving. But I wonder for you, that moment before, you know, when you take that breath, before you sing your first note, what is that moment like for you?
It, for me, it's a call. And I'm taking the audience as part of my community. Some of them, you find that right away, they start crying.
Yeah.
Some of them, you find that right away, they start jumping. As like before I even finished the first nah. Me saying nah, they just jump. It's like, it sounds like that's a wake-up call for them to say, hey, we are being summoned to come and, you know, and enjoy the celebration. And it was something that I told myself when I first took over the role of Rafiki, mm-hmm. that I wasn't going to see the audience as the audience. Mm-hmm. I was going to see the audience as the community in this whole Pride Land. Yeah. And watching their reaction, all of that just gives me all that joy to say, oh, somebody has heard me. They are hearing me. We are, you know, together in this whole thing.
That says so much about you, even after all these years, to still feel, it's one thing for the audience to still feel it, but I can hear it in your voice. I can feel it coming through the line. But it also says a lot about the role and you know, how Julie Taymor turned this into a role for a woman, but also, you know, I've heard you talk about how moving it's been for you to represent your home and your culture in this way. I mean, this is a big role on many fronts, but rare is a role like this, right?
Yes. In my family, I have two now, because my aunt has passed away, but my aunt was a Sangoma, my niece is a Sangoma. My cousin is a Sangoma. The Sangomas are like clairvoyants, right? Mm-hmm. They have this gift where they can connect with the other world. They are all having like different ways mm-hmm. of channeling the ancestors. And when I do my role as Rafiki, I kind of pick one of them and figure out which one mm-hmm. do I want to be today.
Incredible to be able to draw from that. And then so many different languages to... I mean, it's fortunate for audience members to be able to hear you speak them so beautifully.
Right.
What has that felt like for you over these years to expose people who may have never heard different languages?
Here's the funniest thing. This guy said to me, and this one, two of the girls that came in to join the show, this probably like years ago, mm-hmm. they said, so what are you saying over there? Is it a language or is it something that you make up? I said, no, we have cliques. In South Africa, we have three languages that have cliques, the Zulu, the Xhosa, and the Sotho's. And then when I'm clicking, I'm literally saying a word. It kind of fascinates me because now finding, you know, realizing that people don't even think that this is a language, that's something that's made up.
Some more learning on their part to do. Very gracious of you to keep educating them.
That is so true.
There are many languages and they are very real and very beautiful. If we go back in time, CD2, I mean, any actor will know this. You try, sometimes you try for the same role. It took you a couple of tries. In the 90s, it didn't work out. Third time, the auditions come around again and you get the role. Do you remember getting the call?
I remember getting the call. This call comes in. I'm looking at the number. I don't know this number. My first instinct is to just cut off the phone and not listen to whatever. I don't want to hear it. It's a prank. I don't know what this lady said. All I heard was Lion King, Joanna Top, Canada. That's all I heard. I said, wait a minute, let's reverse. I'm so sorry. Please repeat. And that's when she said, congratulations, you just got selected for the Lion King in Canada, a production in Canada. I jumped.
And your life changed in that moment.
Oh, it was like this dark veil that was, you know, covering my face has just been lifted.
And it was actually the production in Toronto.
In Toronto,
and you started in the ensemble, if I recall correctly.
Yes.
And then you slid into the role of Rafiki expertly.
Yes.
And I think I have somewhere in my house that program and that ticket stub from when it was first in Toronto, just across the street from where I'm standing right now to interview you.
Really?
And I just might have seen you as Rafiki. So it's quite a moment, quite a moment to talk to you now. Did you think that you would be playing Rafiki this long, though?
No. Luckily, in Toronto, we had the first, second, and the third understudy, and I was number last. So my day came in. Ooh, you should know that my stomach... Oh my God, all the kind of butterflies you can, the good and bad ones, were just running, rushing all over my body. And then anyway, we get there, we rehearsed. And then that first was so nervous that I thought the audience was booing me.
I think everyone, nobody hated you. They loved you. And that's why. And then you weren't the understudy. You've been on Broadway for all of these years as well. You continued in Toronto and then went to Broadway. Yeah. So why now did you decide that this is the time to leave this role?
I just had a knee surgery on my left leg, and it's because of arthritis. And I wonder if my knees kind of maybe kind of come up with the decision of maybe it's time that I need to take care of me. Mm-hmm. You know, it's been 20 something years, and I wonder if I have been ignoring me as in CD now. Yeah. I need to be okay with the fact that I've done this for so long. Yeah. And I mean, two houses in South Africa, one house here. I took my nieces and my nephews through school with this Lion King. I'm so grateful. Words cannot even express what Lion King has done to me. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it changed.
And I feel like I need to take this 3 minutes. If this is the only minute that I have in life, I need to take this 3 minutes and just remember me.
You absolutely should, CD. And I hope you get all of the free time to do whatever you want or do nothing at all. And I hope you talked about community. I hope your community is there for you in the way you were there for them all these years. Yes, I so appreciate this conversation. Congratulations on everything.
I appreciate that. Thank you so much.
CD Manye is a Broadway actor who's played Rafiki in The Lion King for thousands of performances and will bow out on Sunday evening. We reached her in Jersey City, New Jersey. Now it's time for another exciting look at the latest tech developments in one very specific field of robotics.
Rabbit Innovation.
Yes, welcome back to Rabbit Innovations, our regular check-in on whether there's been any progress in improving the common rabbit, which is outdated. I'll give the usual disclaimer. We like rabbits. We just believe they're primitive, and their whole shtick, the hopping and the button-eyed staring, the relentless reproduction, is in need of a refresh. Now, of course, we know scientists have been working feverishly for years to build a better rabbit. And now, at last, some progress. The South Florida Water Management District has sent a battalion of robot rabbits out into the wild. Now, a regular rabbit moves like a rabbit, is approximately the temperature of a rabbit, and smells exactly like a rabbit. But guess what? The new Florida robot rabbit also moves somewhat like a rabbit, is the temperature of a rabbit, and smells like a rabbit, but is better than a rabbit because it cannot feel fear, which is perfect because these robo-rabbits have one purpose, to attract pythons in the Everglades. Pythons are hard to find, and if they find you first, you have a bad experience, but they love to eat rabbits. Rabbits 1.0, analog rabbits, are hard to control. Rabbits 2.0, the cyborg rabbits, just sit there while the pythons approach. When they get close enough, a camera sends a signal to HQ, and then someone comes out and dispatches the python. No rabbits are injured. So these robo-rabbits are revolutionary, and scientists haven't quite made the original rudimentary rabbit obsolete, but they're a hair's breadth away.
You've been listening.